Luke, the 14th chapter. Now large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going out to wage war against another king, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for the terms of peace. So therefore, none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions." The Gospel of the Lord. The belief among many is that the role of the church is to teach ethics. So let's accept that premise for a moment and look at what ethical teachings are justified in the gospel text for today. We can start with the fact that it is ethical to hate one another, especially your closest family members. Jesus says so. Hate them. That's a good sign of faithfulness. We could make an ethical case for waging war. The only reason that someone would not wage war is if they weren't able to win it, and then they would sign a peace treaty before fighting the war. But Jesus says, if you know you're going to win, fight the war. Or we could make the case for the church demanding you to give up all of its money, and there have been congregations and pastors where the pastor has demanded people have done that, and some families have lived in poverty because they've been giving so much to the church. I haven't seen that happen here, but should you feel the urge to increase your pledge, we would not be greatly offended. So if the church's role is to teach ethics, look at the kind of ethics we can justify. We can justify hate. We can justify war. We can justify robbing families of all of their wealth. What I would like you to consider today is that the role of the church may not be to teach ethics. The role of the church may be to introduce people to Jesus Christ. The first step in re-understanding the role of the church is to take a look at this thing called enthusiasm. In the first section of chapter 14 of Luke, we have a number of times where Jesus is eating a meal with people, and in the eating of that meal, then Jesus teaches them about discipleship, teaches them about status, teaches them about caring for others. But now as we move into this gospel text for today, the location and the people present has changed. We have moved out of the dining room into the out-of-doors, and the people are this enormous crowd of people who have become enthusiastic about the teaching of Jesus. And to the point that Luke writes that large crowds travel with Jesus and listen to everything that he says. Noticing the enthusiasm of these large crowds, what Jesus asks of them is to weigh the cost of their enthusiasm. That is, take your enthusiasm and follow it through to its logical conclusion and see if that's where you really want to be. Count the cost first. So when I was a child, I loved peaches. I still do. It's like the perfect time of year for me because the peaches are out now, and my wife made peach cobbler for dessert last night, which was wonderful, and I had it for breakfast this morning because it is a fruit, so it's a good breakfast food as well. I put ice cream on top of it because what do you do with breakfast food? You put dairy on top of it, and it's like cereal as well, right? Some of you are buying into this, others aren't quite sure. The problem is, as a kid, a peach and an apricot looked alike to me. So I was at the grocery store with my mother, and I looked in the juice aisle, and I noticed what was apricot orange juice. Now, I saw it and thought it was peach orange juice. I probably could have read the carton. That would have helped. But I insisted to my mother that she buy this because I love peaches. And she said, that's not a peach. It's an apricot. It's like the same thing because I was young and stupid then. I'm still seeing if I can recover from that. And I persisted, and she had a moment of parental brilliance. She said, sure, we'll buy it. So the next morning, I'm all excited because I get to drink my new peach orange juice for breakfast, and I pour a glass of it, and I take one sip of it. Ugh. Apricot and peaches don't taste the same. My mother then informed me that she would not buy me any more orange juice until I had finished that carton of apricot orange juice. And so it took me 3 weeks to gag that down a little bit each morning for breakfast. But I finished it, and I have never bought apricot orange juice since. But notice how I went from that enthusiasm and was forced by a responsible parent to follow it through to its natural conclusion, and I saw how much it cost me. What Jesus is asking of his followers is be aware in your enthusiasm for something of how much it's going to cost you. We then make the next step, which is Jesus lays out for his disciples what it's really going to cost them. Now, what Jesus does in this teaching in the gospel text today challenges the current division in the church. The current division in the church is based on the fact that we have assumed that our role is to teach ethics, and so what we have done is we have divided ourselves the way that the larger community outside of the church has divided itself, and so we can find among Christians the Christian right, and we can find the humanist, and we have congealed in one side or another. And Jesus' teachings in this text challenge both approaches. You know, in the Christian rite, and we have those in this congregation who fall into that camp, they hold fast to the fact that they do what the Bible tells them to do. And in the conversations I have with those in the Christian right, I ask the first question is, how do you decide what to pay attention to in the Bible and what not to pay attention to? And they go, oh no, I follow everything in the Bible. And I said, well, that's interesting because your children are still alive. And in the Old Testament, it says if they've ever been disobedient, you can take them out in the field and stone them to death. Well, that's the Old Testament, Pastor. I follow what's in the New Testament. So obviously they've already had some criteria for deciding what they listen to and what they don't listen to. So the next question is, so your wife, when she comes to worship with you, is wearing a hat and always silent? Well, no. So you've decided that not everything in the New Testament is going to be followed. Well, I follow what Jesus says. Ah, now we're getting somewhere. So this is what Jesus says you have to do. You have to give up all of your possessions. I'm not seeing anyone leaving right now and calling an auctioneer. So immediately we discover that we pick and choose from Scripture, those teachings that support our own personal causes. At the same time, it challenges the whole humanist approach as well, because the humanist approach assumes that right or wrong is dependent upon status, that which is powerful, that which is strong, that which is high and mighty is wrong, that which is weak and poor, they're right. And Jesus challenges both. He looks at the king, the high and mighty, the rich one, and says, the king really has to consider the cost of waging war. At the same time, he looks at the rural poor who have a garden or thinking about building a tower so they can keep an eye on the garden and protect the garden from those who would invade. But what happens if you build the foundation and run out of money before you build the rest of the tower? And so even the rural poor are challenged by Jesus. And so that ethic is also challenged. So if it's not about the ethics of the Christian right or the ethics of the humanist, what is this all about? It's about one's relationship with Jesus and what that does to a person who has that relationship. Many, many good things have come out of my marriage relationship with my wife, Connie. And one of the gifts is that her best friend, Steve, has become a very good friend of mine, to the point that we call him Uncle Steve in our family because he's just like a brother to my wife and to me. And Steve is one of those people that when you're with him, you feel better about yourself. Have you ever met someone like that? That in your time with that person, you feel better about who you are. They treat you with respect. They love you for who you are. They listen to who you are. They listen to what you have to say. They show great hospitality. Anytime we spend a couple nights at Steve's house, I leave feeling better about life. My life is better because I know him. So how much more so then will our lives be better if we have a relationship with Jesus? Jesus shows us God. And what we learn about God through Jesus is that God's love for us is overwhelming. That when God looks at us, God takes delight in seeing us. God is the one that when God sees you, God immediately smiles and is happy that God can see you. God is the one that has such high expectations for us because we have remarkable capacity. And yet at the same time, those expectations which are unattainable, God is also merciful and forgiving. So when we fall short, which we will, there's never an if, only a when, God forgives and shows mercy to us and sets us free from that horrible accusing voice that keeps telling us we're not good enough. God does not withhold his own son, Jesus. But Jesus dies so that we might live. That's the Jesus that I want you to know. And that's the purpose of the church, to introduce people to that Jesus. When we shift from seeing the church as providing ethics to the church as introducing people to Jesus, then we also then shift how we go about being God's people in the world. The language that is troublesome in this text is the language of hate. You know, Jesus says here, hating father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters. It's not the first time that Jesus in the Gospel of Luke says that there are going to be problems with family, but he really didn't have to say that because we know that families are these complicated, frustrating, wonderful things all wrapped up into one. But hate here is not the word for that strong emotional rejection we have of someone. But here, hate is the sense of detaching from something, letting something go. And so it's detaching oneself from those things that we think are more important than anything else in life. It's sort of connected to that old story of the man that was walking on this path along this mountain cliff, and he lost his footing and he falls over the edge and he grabs hold of this root that's hanging out the side of the cliff, and he's hanging on for dear life and he starts calling for help, and all of a sudden someone up the top of the cliff says, "I'm here, what do you need?" Said, "I'm hanging on for dear life, can you help me?" And the voice says, "Let go of the branch." And he pauses, he goes, "I'm not sure you understand the situation I'm in. If I let go of the branch, I'm going to fall to my death." And the voice again says, "Let go of the branch." And the man said, "You know, if you were God, I might consider letting go of the branch." And the voice says, "I am God, let go of the branch." And the man finally responds, "Is there anyone else up there at the top of the cliff?" Because we don't want to detach or let go. But this creates a problem because Luke also teaches us not to test God by letting go. So if you think about Jesus being tempted by Satan in the wilderness, Satan takes him to this high place and says what to him? "Jump down and the angels of God will scoop you up and you won't even scratch your toe on a stone." And Jesus' response is this: "Don't put the Lord your God to the test." So we live in this tension of detaching but not testing God. And how is that played out? That's played out by us counting the cost of what we do and what we say. weighing the implications of our words and our actions and our beliefs. Counting the cost has a number of components to it. One of the components to counting the cost is, once we have drawn a conclusion, is for us to test the facts, to see if the facts support the conclusion. So it was maybe about a year and a half ago that a concerned member of the community stopped in to my office during the week and said to me, "I need to talk to you about the two new pastors here at Trinity." But holy moly, what have they done already? There's God here, you know? And I mean, I'm concerned about people from Minnesota anyway, but I thought, okay, let's hear this out. They said, "Well, the other day I saw them together, and at first they were holding hands." Okay. And that was made me feel uncomfortable. And then they kissed each other. I think that's really inappropriate for two pastors of Trinity to be holding hands and kissing each other. And after it dawned on me what was going on, I said, "Do you realize that they are husband and wife?" Oh. They didn't have the facts. They drew the conclusion and went at it from there. If you want to determine what it is that you need to detach from, then I recommend you ask yourself this question: what has been consuming you the last 2 weeks? What has it been that's been on your mind when you wake up, on your mind when you go to sleep? It might wake you up in the middle of the night. It might shape your conversations during the day. And we've got the Hetricks here. He just had a wedding yesterday. I can tell what was consuming your thought for the last 2 weeks. What has been consuming your time and energy for the last 2 weeks? And test that. Is it life-giving? Or is it something that's going to bring harm to you and to others? Because that's the choice God's people are given in the first lesson. The cost is it life-giving? Giving and life affirming. Lifting up what God's people are capable of doing and being. We can easily become a church that is all about ethics. But I'm not sure that that's the role of the church. I believe it's the role of the church to introduce people to Jesus. Because in introducing people to Jesus, they encounter that life-giving and life-transforming presence. And in that presence, they encounter the gift of life. May that be, then, what we strive to do as God's people, introducing them to Jesus Christ. Amen.